Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miroboard. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miroboard?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
From ABC News, this is Perspective. This week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, with September looming and the virus raging, schools are scrambling.
What's the sweet spot where safety is the priority, but so is education and the mental and social well-being of millions of American school children?
The Attorney General admits there is a bias in American policing.
African-American males particularly are treated with extra suspicion and maybe not given the benefit of the doubt.
And pro sports teams with Native American names are considering changing them. But why now?
What this moment, cultural reckoning, has become is just to say, okay, now is the time to finally get rid of these things.
All ahead on Perspective. The country emerged from the 4th of July holiday facing a new challenge, the continuing increase in COVID-19 cases, a staggering number of people unemployed, and a desire to get students back in school this fall in the midst of the pandemic. Another 1.3 million Americans filed for first-time unemployment benefits, while in Arizona, Texas, California, Florida, Colorado, and Michigan, hospital beds are filling up so fast they had to reverse reopenings in many cases. In Phoenix, where 1 out of 3 people are turning up positive, people are waiting hours in line for testing and 10 days to find out the results. Phoenix Dr. Sam Durrani.
We cannot do enough testing to keep up with how many positives we're having. We need more rapid, reliable testing. The same testing that they get at the White House, that needs to be widely available to the community. If we had that, we could identify positives quicker and we could isolate them and prevent them from spreading.
Parents are clearly nervous about sending their kids back into the classroom. Erin Baker is in Arizona. Like millions, she's not a fan of remote learning, but she's also not a fan of putting her kids in danger.
The bigger picture stresses me out so much because I really feel like school is a fabric of society, and I don't understand how they're going to make this work.
Dr. Ashish Jha, who heads up the Harvard Global Health Initiative, told ABC's Good Morning America this week that before schools even think about reopening, other things need to close down because the virus is spreading too fast.
We need to close bars. We need to close indoor large gatherings. We need to have everybody wearing masks. If we start all that now, I think there's a pretty good shot we can open schools and keep them open all fall.
President Trump this week said schools should open and will open for in-person learning this fall, or they'll lose federal funding. As for safety measures, he's leaving that up to the states and school districts. Lily Eskelson Garcia is president of the 3 million member National Education Association. She says, wait a minute, let's think about teachers too.
I want Donald Trump to sit in the back of my class of 39 and breathe their air.
Now, ABC's Karen Travers was in the room when the White House held a forum this week on getting kids back in school. She and I talked about it afterwards. Tell us about the meeting with President Trump and all the school leaders and what their thoughts are about getting kids back into school in the fall.
President Trump's thoughts are very clear. He tweeted earlier this week in all caps, schools must reopen in the fall. So, okay, that's what the president wants to see done. And then at the White House on Tuesday, the president said he was going to put pressure on governors to reopen schools. But Sherry, all of the experts that we have talked to and teachers and state and local officials, it's not as simple as, you know, the schools are open or the schools are closed. It's not black or white, either or. Schools will be open, but the question is, what are they going to look like? What is open? And it's going to be very different across the country. That's something that's concerning to education experts, that there could be a significant disparity in the types of education that kids are getting all across the country. And what we're hearing now, some states have already announced they'll go back full time. At minimum 5 days a week, kids are in the classrooms, everything is back to normal. That's places like Florida. But other places are saying what they're going to do is stagger it, do social distancing. But to do that, you have to have less kids in the classroom. So some kids might go to school 1 week, then they will be home for the next week, and then maybe they go back the third week. The key there is, of course, the teachers are in that entire time. Teachers have to do the in-person learning. So when the students are at home doing distance learning, they kind of are on their own, and it's up to their parents.
I know plenty of teachers in my own family and lots of friends. You know lots of friends who are teachers and family members. They are beside themselves. It's just in complete disarray.
It really is. And I think the clear message from the Trump administration has been this is up to state and local governments to figure out, that the federal government will be there in a supporting role. That's how it was described to us this week. But they're not going to say, here's the blueprint everybody has to follow. Well, for some places, they think that's good. You know, let us figure it out because our cases are different here in D.C. or New Jersey compared to Arizona and Texas. Sure. But that also means that there just could be such a tumultuous rollout to these plans, as we saw in the spring with distance learning. A big concern that we're hearing from teachers is, you know, how are they going to stay safe? You know, you are around kids all the time as a teacher. They're used to getting colds. They're used to getting the flu. Kids are germy. They're always asking for Clorox wipes at my kid's school. But ramp that up to pandemic level, and there's a lot of money that will be needed to do this. We're hearing numbers, you know, like over $100 billion would be needed to be infused into the education system for state and local governments to pull this off. And that money is just not there right now for Congress.
There was a great article in the New York Times last week, and it was about parents with kids. And it said you can either have a job or you can have kids, but you can't have both in the pandemic. And that's really what parents are facing as well. They want schools open, but they also want their kids to be safe.
And they want their kids' teachers to be safe. They want the older people that work in the cafeteria or the front office to be safe. So everybody, I think, is trying to figure out what's the right balance here. What's the sweet spot where safety is the priority, but so is education and the mental and social well-being of millions of American school children. And I thought that piece, I mean, my goodness, could that have been shared anymore on social media? Every single person I know is sharing it, moms and dads and caregivers, saying, you know, this is just unsustainable. And it was fine-ish in the spring when you were like, all right, it's April. I can just get to the end of May. It's May. I can just get to the end of this month. But looking at it in August as potentially an entire year of this, everything suffers. The kids' education is suffering. Parents who are trying to work from home, their workload is suffering. Sherry, I have friends who are teachers, who both the couple, husband and wife, are both teachers, and they have three kids who are in school. You know, how are they going to do that this year? And they're worried about bringing things home. I mean, there's just such a Pandora's box that's opened up of so many issues, and people have big concerns about this. But as you say, I think everybody does want to get their kids back to school. They know it's the best thing to do, but how do you do it right?
As the mom of three young kids, how are you holding up?
We are okay so far.
Everything is okay. Relative.
And I think it's so funny to hear people when you talk to your friends, like nobody wants to say that they have it the worst. You know, as I always say to our friends, well, a rising second grader, like she's been fine. She's figured things out through the computer. And it's not like she's doing school for 7 hours a day. We have preschool twins. They'll figure it out too. Then I say, well, it's probably worse for my friends that have middle school students or high school students. And they'll say, well, I think it's worse for you because your kids could get into trouble if you don't watch them every second of the day. My kids at least can just play on the computer all the time. So there's certainly like a benevolent, I think, approach among friend groups to say, like, everybody has this very tough right now. And everybody understands there's a lot of challenges to make this easier.
ABC's Karen Travers, thank you so much.
Have a great day.
Take care. So let's discuss a little bit about that essay, the one Karen and her friends were sending around. ABC's Becky Worley talked with the author this week.
Across the nation, school districts are deciding what the classroom will look like this fall as parents struggle to hang on.
We can't keep up with this. Everybody is overwhelmed and everybody has their hands tied.
In a New York Times article titled, "In the COVID-19 Economy, You Can Have a Kid or a Job, You Can't Have Both," Deb Perlman, a New York City mom and author, says her school district is considering sending students back only part-time, physically attending school one out of every 3 weeks. But she says that does little to help parents desperate for normal routine.
There are people who have hit pause, like been able to hit the pause button on a project under the idea that September would return some level of normalcy in childcare and like not having your kids there all day. And now they can't. And they're really afraid they're going to have to leave the workforce.
The American Academy of Pediatrics, who recently released guidelines for reopening schools, says they too want kids physically in class, pointing to its major health, social, and educational benefits. But for back to school, there's no one-size-fits-all solution, since the virus looks different in different places.
We cannot protect kids from all risk, but we're going to have to decide week by week or month by month, is it riskier to send kids to school and have everyone's health be in jeopardy? Or is it riskier to keep kids home and have everyone's finances and ability to pay their bills be in jeopardy?
ABC's Becky Worley. Years ago at about this time, this is what we were promoting here on ABC News.
There's some of the most significant nights in the election of a president. Join me, ABC's Aaron Katursky, and our powerhouse political team for live coverage of the Republican National Convention from Cleveland tonight, right here.
Oh, that's so 2016, isn't it? Fills you with nostalgia, makes you wonder what this year's conventions will be like. One of them, the Democratic Convention, was supposed to be held next week. Now, they'll both be held next month, and they'll both be different. Democrats will be in Milwaukee, somewhat. The Republicans in Charlotte, and then in Jacksonville, Florida. But what of the balloons and the speeches and the platform and the state roll calls? Will people be wearing masks? What about social distancing? It's all going to be very different. ABC News political director Rick Klein says the whole thing is just weird.
Well, according to the Republicans, there will be a convention, actually kind of one and a half conventions. They're going to start things off in Charlotte, which was the original convention location, do some party business, including actually nominating Donald Trump for a second term. And then they're going to move the party, and I do mean a party, to Jacksonville, Florida, where they're expecting to have major gatherings over several nights that they say at this point will look a lot like conventions of years past. As hard as it is to imagine the massive gatherings of people, they are talking about tens of thousands of individuals converging on Jacksonville for a convention in person.
I humbly and gratefully accept your nomination for the presidency of the United States.
Florida is not doing very well when it comes to coronavirus. That doesn't worry anybody?
Well, it does worry lots of folks in Florida and some Republicans quietly, but one person it doesn't seem to worry is Donald Trump, and it is his convention, it is his party. We have heard from convention officials and Republican National Committee officials that they will comply with all of the local guidelines, all the ordinances, and all the regulations that are in place, both the local and state level. But Jacksonville is a place that has a Republican mayor, Florida is a place with a Republican governor, and we've seen a propensity for Republican elected officials to try to bend over backwards to allow things to look much like Donald Trump would want it to look.
Tell me a little bit about the Democratic convention and their plans for Milwaukee, because it's pretty different, isn't it?
We've had candidates before who attempted to get elected by appealing to our fears, but they've never succeeded because we do not scare easily.
The Democrats from the beginning have been honest about the need to modify their plans for the realities of the COVID-19 age. And regardless of the situation specific in Milwaukee, they've already taken steps. First of all, they pushed the convention back by an entire month. It was supposed to be happening just next week. Instead, it's going to be happening in the middle of August. They've also signaled very strongly that they plan to move large chunks of the convention to essentially being a virtual convention.
With the exception of a world war, can you think of any time in political history where, the election really hinges on one huge story, and that's coronavirus right now?
I think this is about as big a story as one can imagine looming over everything in politics. And I think there's actually a few tentacles to it, because it's not just the health pandemic of COVID-19. It's also the economic collapse that occurred around it. And I think you layer on top of that the social justice protests, the Black Lives Matter movement. And in that sense, everything is reset. Everything we thought this election might be about, no longer operative. We spent a lot of time on Ukraine and impeachment, and those were huge events. That itself was unprecedented. We remember the Mueller investigation. All of that pales in comparison to the very real crises that people are living at this moment. And I do think you have to put it right up there with the World War to try to find anything comparable in terms of the overall political impact.
ABC News political director Rick Klein on the 2020 election. Attorney General William Barr admitted something this week that was surprising to a lot of people. He said he does think there is a bias in American policing when it comes to black men. He sat down for an exclusive interview with ABC's Pierre Thomas.
In the wake of nationwide protests spurred by the death of George Floyd, Attorney General William Barr acknowledging African Americans do face bias in policing.
I do think that it is a widespread phenomenon that African American males particularly are treated with extra suspicion and maybe not given the benefit of the doubt.
While Barr acknowledges there is some police reform needed, he remains steadfast that most police are doing a good job, and he rejects any notion of defunding law enforcement. But Barr chose not to engage on the question of whether the president was stoking racial tensions.
What's your view of Black Lives Matter, and are you willing to say Black Lives Matter?
I'd make a distinction between the organization, which I don't agree with. They have a broader agenda. But in terms of the proposition that Black Lives Matter, obviously Black Lives Matter. I think all lives, all human life is sacred.
We pressed Barr about that moment in June when mostly peaceful protesters were cleared out of Lafayette Park by force. Barr said he wanted the perimeter expanded, but it had nothing to do with that photo op.
The plan was to move the demonstrators up toward I Street to take the pressure off Lafayette. We had gone through three nights of rioting. There had been fires set. There had been 80 or 90 federal officers injured. And we were determined that that wasn't going to go on for a fourth night.
And you're not uncomfortable with what you saw?
No.
That's ABC Chief Justice Correspondent Pierre Thomas with the Attorney General of the United States, William Barr. Law enforcement officials were worried at the beginning of the pandemic job loss and a struggling economy would lead to an uptick in violent crime and shootings. Crime went down in April, actually, but since, we've seen it rise, very much so over the 4th of July weekend, when several children were among the victims of gun violence across the country.
Thoughts and prayers are simply not enough at this point.
Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot saying enough is enough after a 7-year-old girl was shot and killed at a family gathering last weekend.
I sincerely pray on behalf of a grieving city that you are able to recognize the consequences of what you've done.
So what's changed? John Cohen's a former police officer in South Central LA, and he's also a former official with the Homeland Security Department. He talked about what can be done about the violence with ABC's Brad Milkey on our daily news podcast, Start Here.
So, John, why are we seeing this increase? Because, like, police have always said, you know, you might see more violence in the summer, but it looked for a while like criminals are scared of COVID, too. Everyone's going to stay home. What's changed?
What's compounding it now is that you have had people who were closed in because of the COVID crisis who are now out. There is an increase in people who've lost their jobs. Mm. We're seeing increases in substance abuse. We've seen increases in domestic violence. So all those factors are coming together. And the result is we're seeing an increase, a dramatic increase in violent crime, particularly in major cities. We're also experiencing a major national debate on race and policing. And I've heard from a number of chiefs that is resulting in police officers, being less aggressive as far as dealing with gang members.
But wait, why would the job of police change in this? Like, if you see someone get shot, like, you still go arrest the shooter, right, John?
That's right. But the way you prevent violent crime from occurring is you typically surge police officers in those neighborhoods where the violent crime tends to occur. And that violent crime tends to occur in lower income communities of color. But in today's environment, particularly when you have neighborhoods telling the police, we don't want you here. Police agencies are hesitant and police officers are hesitant to use those traditional strategies.
And activists, of course, have said, we do want police in our neighborhoods if they can keep from escalating situations, particularly with unarmed individuals. But John, I thought it was interesting. Bill de Blasio, the very liberal mayor of New York, he basically said he blamed this on the pandemic, but because he said the courts are no longer prosecuting criminals, they're not throwing the bad guys behind bars, and his own police force is saying you're also letting criminals out of jail. But I thought that was like the nonviolent ones. So what's the problem there?
You often hear about, particularly when we're talking about the release of people who are in jail, that they're only releasing nonviolent offenders. Well, people who are incarcerated because they were prosecuted for a nonviolent offense may actually have a long record of violent behavior. You're going to hear people talking about calling in the National Guard or even the military. That would be a huge mistake. Military and National Guardsmen, they're not trained to police our cities. So, those calls are misplaced, and this really would be a recipe for disaster.
John Cohen, thank you so much.
Talk to you soon, Brad.
Coming up, the name of that football team in Washington. Should it be changed? We'll talk more about it on Perspective after this.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
From ABC News, this is Perspective, the week's top stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, one company's goal to absorb the cost of the pink tax, even during the pandemic. But first, President Trump weighed in this week on the Washington NFL team and the Cleveland Indians baseball team considering changing their names. Names that Native Americans have long said are racist. Both franchises announced they're reviewing their names, and changes may be coming before the 2020 NFL and Major League Baseball seasons begin. Perspective's producer, ABC's Eric Mallow, has more.
With America in the midst of a reckoning over racial inequality, more athletes are continuing to speak out across the sports world.
I'll be doing. Stand for what's right.
Arizona Cardinals quarterback Kyler Murray announcing he'll be taking a knee during the playing of the national anthem this year, one of several players pledging to stand in solidarity with former NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick, who knelt during the playing of the national anthem to protest police brutality and social injustice in America. Over the past week, there's been another reckoning in sports, whether to change team names or logos that contain Native American emblems and stereotypes.
I think it's time to move forward.
Major League Baseball's Cleveland Indians announced they're considering changing the team's name. Manager Terry Francona feels now is an appropriate time for change.
I know that we're never trying to be disrespectful, and I still feel that way. But I don't think that's a good enough answer today.
The announcement comes a little over a year after Cleveland removed its Chief Wahoo logo, a cartoonish caricature of a Native American man long considered racist. It also came shortly after the announcement that Washington's NFL franchise is weighing whether to change its team name, which is widely regarded as a racial slur. Julian Brave Noisecat contributes to ESPN's The Undefeated. He writes that the team name references Native American skin color in the bloody scalps of indigenous people taken as bounty by white colonists.
If a group of people are speaking out about the racism of a team logo, it's quite the thing to go and claim that actually, no, you are honoring them. And it's hard for me to imagine the same thing happening for another racial group in the United States.
Team owner Dan Snyder has vowed for years he'd never change the name, saying the term actually embodies honor respect, and pride. Protesters and advocacy groups have called for change for decades, but only in the face of mounting economic pressure did Snyder finally announce they're reconsidering. Investors with major sponsors from Pepsi, FedEx, and Nike sent letters asking the companies to terminate their relationship with Washington unless it agreed to a name change.
Which, you know, kind of is exciting on the one hand, but the reality it reveals about the power of capital in our culture and society is a little bit of a downer for me.
But those two franchises don't stand alone.
A world without native mascots is the ideal world.
Nick Martin is a member of the Saponi tribe and a staff writer for the New Republic.
Any kind of imagery like that, and specifically as it relates to Native people, because we have been made invisible forcibly, the idea that we would, you know, get rid of the Washington NFL team and keep the Kansas City Chiefs, it speaks to a certain hollowness that I think this kind of corporate social justice campaigns often involve.
The Kansas City Chiefs, Atlanta Braves, and Chicago Blackhawks are among professional franchises that continue to employ Native American imagery on their jerseys, in their team names, and in cheers by fans.
It's become a very normalized thing, which I think is commonplace with a lot of systems and forms of institutional oppression. These things, we don't think of them in the moment as being particularly egregious because they've become so normalized in society.
Those franchises aren't following the lead of Washington and Cleveland. None of them announced name changes, though Atlanta is reportedly considering no longer allowing the tomahawk chop chants at games. And the Blackhawks went on to say that their team name and logo symbolizes an important Native American figure, and they aren't moving toward formal change.
It reduces you to a caricature. There are 570 plus tribal nations. That's 570 plus tribal cultures. Any kind of idea that like there is one kind of Indian is a very reductionist kind of view of us.
President Trump even weighed in this week via Twitter, saying the names of Washington's and Cleveland's teams signify strength and not weakness, and they're merely considering the change to be politically correct. The president's statement and the very decisions of these franchises do raise questions. Is it important to distinguish between the offensiveness of each individual team name? And does any of this iconography actually honor or respect Native Americans? Or in saying team names and logos honor Native people, is that merely perpetuating cultural appropriation and the use of stereotypical Native American imagery? Martin says it's not that slippery of a slope.
If you're saying our mascot, our team name, it's not as racist as Washington NFL team. That's still an admission that it is racist.
Washington's head coach Ron Rivera, who's one of four minority head coaches in the NFL, told the Washington Post it would be awesome if the team changed its name. And the National Congress of American Indians have long opposed the use of Native American stereotypical imagery in professional sports. As professional sports franchises are choosing to re-examine these issues in the midst of America's reckoning over race relations, they're faced with a new choice. Will economic pressures determine if they choose to rename their teams, or will they listen to decades-long calls from Native American advocacy groups to eliminate the use of these emblems?
The only reason it's happening so swiftly is because this is something that Native people have put years of groundwork into. And so what this moment kind of larger cultural reckoning has become is just kind of an impetus to say, okay, you know, now is the time to finally get rid of these things.
Reporting for Perspective, I'm Eric Malo, ABC News.
The mystery surrounding the death of a 20-year-old Army soldier named Vanessa Guillen has sparked outrage across the country and calls for change in Congress. Guillen had complained about being sexually harassed by a fellow soldier, but her family says she kept mostly quiet about it because she was afraid it would affect her career. She disappeared back in April, but it wasn't until this past week that her remains were found and identified. They're not far from Fort Hood, where she was stationed. ABC's Stephanie Ramos tells us more about Vanessa Guillen's disappearance.
The Army telling the grieving family of Vanessa Guillen that remains found are indeed her. This as marchers throughout Texas are demanding a congressional investigation into the disappearance and murder of the Army soldier. Army investigators say the 20-year-old who went missing in April was killed and dismembered by a fellow soldier at Fort Hood in Killeen, Texas. Authorities say the suspect in her disappearance, Aaron Robinson, shot and killed himself Wednesday as investigators closed in on him. His girlfriend, 22-year-old Cecily Aguilar, arrested. Investigators say she confessed that Robinson told her he'd bludgeoned Guillen to death with a hammer, adding that Robinson then drove her to a nearby river where they dismembered Guillen's body using a, quote, hatchet or axe and a machete-type knife.
Investigators discovering remains about 20 miles away from the base. For months, Guillen's family claims the Army did not take her disappearance seriously.
And Stephanie joins me now to talk more about it. Tell us more about the case and why it's getting so much attention now. Why did it take so long to make these headlines?
This case is getting a lot more attention now because I believe the family of Vanessa Guillen was so impressively aggressive in getting the word out that Vanessa was missing. Family is also asking, why did it take the Army so long to find Vanessa, to put the pieces together, to locate the suspects? More than 2 months passed before there were any answers.
She was from Texas. She always wanted to be in the Army. What is the military saying about the harassment and those kinds of accusations that were going on in her case?
Vanessa's family, they have said that Vanessa shared with them she had been sexually harassed by a superior soldier. The Army just recently said they would investigate those claims, but say they have not found any evidence of that. Sexual harassment and assault is a big problem in the military, but there have been a number of programs put in place to curb these incidents, but it's still a problem. A recent Pentagon survey that was released last year shows that the number of sexual assaults increased in 2018 to 20,500, almost the same levels as 5 years prior. So this is clearly still an issue in the military that they're trying to work on with the various programs that they have in place.
What kind of changes do you think it could lead to in the military? I mean, first of all, you have to investigate the killing itself, but the eventual changes it might lead to in the military. Do you see that happening?
We've heard from the commander at Fort Hood. He acknowledged that he could have done a better job with this entire situation. He has said that he was trying to protect the investigation, and in doing so, he failed to really inform the family. I would imagine that a lot of the leaders at Fort Hood have learned from this process. And that's probably something that they'll work on, just the process when they're faced with a difficult situation like this. How do they protect the investigation, but also protect the family and let them know what's going on? But as far as changes to programs, right now we know that they have the SHARP program, which is the Army's Sexual Harassment Assault Response and Prevention Program, where soldiers are educated on the issues surrounding sexual violence, and those who experience incidents can report it to a designated victim's advocate. You know, that's something that me, being in the Army Reserve for 18 years, I've heard about since the start of my career in the Army. And that every 6 months, there's like another group class where you go over the SHARP program again. That's their way of ensuring that everybody knows what you do if you're in a situation like this. What the family is doing, they're pushing for legislation to get rid of the SHARP program. They want an outside agency to take in those reports of sexual harassment and assault. The family says that this type of program needs to exist outside of the military, because oftentimes that designated victim's advocate is someone in the same unit.
Can you tell us how big a deal this case has been in Spanish-speaking households? I know the League of United Latin American Citizens has encouraged Latinos not to join on the community. How significant is this?
It's huge. Vanessa's case was on Spanish language newscasts from the start. This was an American soldier that had gone missing, yet no one in American media was covering it until now. Organizations like LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens, they're encouraging Latinos not to join the military until there are answers. I spoke with LULAC's CEO, and she says for about 100 years, this organization has protected and defended communities. And it's, they say they've been the most patriotic national Latino organization. And they understand that the military provides a lot of opportunities for people of color, for Latinos, for someone who's really trying to make a better life for themselves. But they are so angered that it took this long to find out what happened to Vanessa. They want answers. They want the military to enforce their policies and regulation and come forward with more details as to why did this happen to her on the base? Where is the surveillance video? What was the relationship between Robinson, Aguilar, and Vanessa? They have so many questions, and they say Latinos should not join the military at this point because they're giving their lives for this country, yet Vanessa lost her life on an American military base, and there are still so many questions.
Stephanie Ramos, thank you so much. Really interesting stuff. Appreciate it so much.
Thanks for having me, Sherry.
It's July, meaning you've been home for the past 4 months, and chances are pretty good you've been ordering a few things online from Amazon or one of the online big box retailers out there. Last year, we spoke with Che Wang, the CEO of one of them, aptly called Boxed, about his company's mission to keep their customers from paying the pink tax.
If it's a sales tax that we have to collect, we still have to collect it by law. So we collect it, but we give you a discount so it's as if you were not taxed on it. If we find a disparity in prices simply because of the color of an item, we then lower the price of the kind of unfairly priced item. I fundamentally believe that it is the right business ethos as well. We're not social crusaders, we're not a charity, but I think in the medium to long run, this will pay off.
ABC's Daria Albinger spoke with Che again this week about how his company has adjusted during the pandemic and how Boxed is still keeping its pink tax promise.
In 2013, Che Huang was a New York City lawyer who was beginning to think that his chosen profession wasn't what he wanted to do for the rest of his life. So he started up a small business in his parents' garage. 3 years later, that little enterprise became Boxed.
We're not aggressively out there advertising and still growing pretty rapidly. Then what's really going on? And I think there's a lot of folks going out there saying, who can I trust during this period? And so that trust factor has driven folks away from other channels and towards us.
Huang putting the company into the headlines with a declaration that they would not charge customers a pink tax.
Absolutely. You know, the pink tax is still a very, very key component to us taking a stand on certain issues that we feel very strongly about here at Boxed. And what you find is in over 30 states in America, women are charged basically a sales tax or a luxury goods tax on feminine care products like tampons and pads. In a lot of those same jurisdictions, you'll find that actually condoms and Rogaine are not taxed because those are seen as necessities. Well, for the women listening to this, or for the men listening to this who have ever bought tampons or pads for a loved one, you know they are necessities.
So how does Boxed get around it?
Of course, by law, we have to collect that tax, but we then rebate it back to our customer on the back end. So that's an initiative we're really proud of and that we will continue as long as I'm here at the helm of this company.
And all of this put Boxed in a pretty enviable position, making some of the bigger e-tailers take notice. And then came COVID-19.
Between rapid growth in our business, really getting used to working from home, and also between all the new measures we've had to put in place in our fulfillment centers, the company today looks a lot different than it did even, call it 120 days ago.
And Huang says that's had its own set of challenges and some nice little surprises.
What's been really wonderful to see and what's really interesting is in the beginning, it was a little bit of everyone getting used to the new technology. And now I feel like most folks have adapted to it and have kind of embraced that newfound freedom. The other side of our staff, though, the majority of whom are in our fulfillment centers, doesn't have that luxury of working from home. And so they still have to come in to work every day. And it's been incumbent upon us to do everything we can to keep them safe.
But really, how has it changed the business?
It's a very interesting shift towards at-home goods as well. So I never thought I would say this ever in my life, but of course, toilet paper has become a hot commodity, but so has flour. Typical all-purpose flour has become a hot commodity as folks stay home, start to find the inner baker in them. And especially as we go into back to school, I do feel like we will see another surge of demand when it comes to everyday snacks and cleaning items.
By the way, he says one of those biggest selling products, it's given him some new street cred.
One of the biggest surprises was just how crazy the demand around toilet paper got. I used to joke tongue-in-cheek that, you know, I'm just a toilet paper salesperson. But being a toilet paper salesman has done over the last 90 days has created an environment in which I've become the most popular person in my high school about 20 years too late.
And while he says some things have changed, others, well, they really haven't.
We are a core part of that supply chain of moving feminine care products throughout the country. And so it is an issue that we can make change in. And so that's why we were the first national retailer to take a stand on that issue.
Reporting for Perspective, Daria Albinger, ABC News.
From ABC News, this has been Perspective. Thanks for listening. If you want to listen to any of our past shows, you can subscribe to the Perspective podcast. Give us a review if you've got the time. Tell us what you like and what you'd like to hear in the future. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find Perspective and other ABC News shows at abcnewspodcasts.com. Perspective is produced by Eric Mollo. For ABC News, I'm Sherry Preston.